You're listening to the River East Church Podcast, a Jesus community for the world.
Good morning. My name is Jana Welk, and it's a privilege to share with you this morning words from Jeff Chu. I first heard this sermon as a podcast during the pandemic, during the don't leave your house era. And in this time of uncertainty and increasing division between groups with different opinions, I really miss the prophetic words of Rachel Held Evans, who had been an influential writer as my faith evolved throughout my young adulthood. And in searching for her words, I stumbled upon this podcast sermon from Jeff Chu about compost. And this was originally preached during the Evolving Faith Conference. The imagery in the sermon has just stuck with me ever since. I love the poetry of Jeff's intro that Marianne shared with us, and the story of resurrection woven throughout ordinary aspects of everyday life, like cooking and eating. These words and images continue to give me hope when, especially today, the world feels bleak, and reminds me that God continues to be at work, often below the surface, persistently, relentlessly, churning death and decay into life and abundance, and repairing relationships that were broken. I've also learned that I have a hard time remembering sermons sometimes, but I'm more likely to remember sermons that talk about poop. So keep your ears open for my favorite part. Jeff Chu is the author of Does Jesus Really Love Me? A Gay Christian's Pilgrimage in Search of God in America, Good Soil, which is my current summer read, and co-author along with Rachel Held Evans of Wholehearted Faith. This sermon comes from Jeff's time as a Princeton Theological Seminary master's student taking classes at the Farminary, where students learn about faith through practical experience working as farmhands together in community. The greeting that Marianne shared is taken from the beginning of this sermon, and I want to repeat that key takeaway for people like me that can only really retain one or two things at a time. You are loved, and we're so glad you're here. So if you absorb nothing else this morning, please remember that. I'm now going to put on my Jeff Chu hat. You come down this long gravel driveway. You'll see a pond to the left where the geese like to rest. And in the early morning, a cloud of mist hangs over it, just as the sun begins to peek over the trees. And it looks soft enough to wrap around you like a blanket. And to the right is our garden. It's 100 by 100 now. We'll expand it next season. Our peppers did pretty well, and so did our dahlias this season. Our tomatoes did fine, but the soil isn't rich enough for the heirloom varieties. We need compost to enrich the soil, and we're making it. It's being made on our compost pile, which to me is the most beautiful place on the farm. It's just past the far garden fence. I did not know much about compost before, but I now know that it preaches 100 Sunday sermons about death becoming new life, about God's abundance, and how these things that seem useless, moldy fruit, onion skins, eggshells, coffee grounds, these become rich soil. The more time I spend at the compost pile, the more I wonder whether one thing we might need is a robust theology of compost. The more time I spend at the compost pile, the more I think we must help write a narrative of hope amidst the world's narrative of despair. And the more time I spend at the compost pile, the more I ask, isn't the story of compost really just the story of God, turning fear to courage, joy to sorrow, death to life? As I said, I'm Jeff, Reformed. So So I'm supposed to adore John Calvin. And what can man do, Calvin wrote, man who is but rottenness and a worm. A version of this story of wretchedness still thrives today, a version that's been weaponized against many of us, especially those who were deemed more wretched than others, women, queer people, trans people, people who have been labeled other. And much of my life, I believed this bad news and this lie. A robust theology of compost teaches me of the good news. A long-dead theologian who apparently knew little about farming but chose to mansplain it to us anyway, what Calvin had to say about worms was wrong. Worms can be magic. Worms can be engines of redemption. Worms devour things of death and poop out life. And God gave their poop that power. A robust theology of compost reminds us that death and the things of death, our sin, our suffering, the ways we hurt each other, the ways we harm ourselves, these things are never the end of God's story. A robust theology of compost reminds us that we are still in the process of becoming, and that God has written the story of redemption into creation itself. A robust theology of compost reminds us that God has empowered us lowly worms to turn what is ugly and festering and dying into what is lovely and beautiful and life-giving. A robust theology of the compost testifies to the fact that we can't do this alone, but we need others, because a single worm can't do very much, but in community, they have such tremendous power. A robust theology of the compost testifies that we who have been told by society that we are worthless can act in confidence of the knowledge that we are worthy. A robust theology of the compost testifies that God urges those of us who have been shamed not to shame, but instead to love, because in our acts of love, we participate in preparing the soil in which God's reign of love and justice can take root. You all know that love is risky. The payoff may not come for years or in this lifetime. I want to read to you a story, this is still Jeff, that I wrote a few years ago about the kind of love and how I learned about it from my mom. It turns out sometimes we're emotionally composting and we don't even know it. This story is called The Making of a Meal. I'm still reading a story Jeff told. For lunch today, I had some steamed spare ribs over rice. These ribs have been in my fridge for over a week, and not a word from you food safety hardliners. My stomach is not just fine, it is also full, and so is my heart. My mom cooked these ribs when she was visiting, and they were some of the best I've ever eaten. I don't know how to make ribs like my mom's. Part of it is, I think, that something tastes better when someone else has cooked it. Another part of it is my mom's secret sauce. Some elixir containing Chaoching wine, black pepper, black bean sauce, salt, sesame oil. I can't really remember. I'm sure she's told me before. It's easy, I hear her say. And a third part of it, though, is something that has nothing to do with the food itself, so much as what the food represents. Last winter, my mom emailed me to ask whether I might like for her to come to New York and cook a dinner for you for your birthday. When I read her words, my heart leapt into hyperspeed. I broke out into a sweat. She hadn't been to visit in years. Not since my boyfriend and I moved in together. Not since that boyfriend became my husband. She had only met him once, and that meeting was, to be generous, awkward. She didn't come to our wedding, and some months later, She did send that email. Food is, in our family, so many things. It's what we fight about. We started taking cruises together, partly because there's no debate about where to have dinner. Eating is our most beloved group activity. And it's the one thing we can always talk about, even when we have nothing else. If I'm at loss for something to say to my mom, I can always ask her, and genuinely, because I always want to know, how to cook a particular dish. And for my mother, food plays a specific and important role, saying things that she cannot. 11 friends joined us, dear and patient people who have played their own supportive paths on our journey, and who knew that this meal wasn't just about food. That Saturday, it turned out my mom had prepared a dish for each of us. At 5:30 p.m., they began coming out of the kitchen. First, the starters. Freshly grilled scallion pancakes, spring rolls, seaweed-wrapped sticky rice balls with Chinese sausage and dried shrimp. And then the mains. Scrambled egg and tomato, a half dozen types of mushroom braised with abalone, big piles of Chinese greens dressed in oyster sauce, slivers of pork tossed with crisp triangles with two kinds of tofu, two chickens, one steamed and one poached in soy sauce, shrimp, stir-fried with a multicolored medley of vegetables, two whole black bass steamed with ginger and green onions, a beef stew with big gooey chunks of tendon, and those spare ribs. This was her gift, her gesture of lavish love, her way of saying she's trying. She started cooking more than 24 hours before the first guest arrived, standing and stirring and chopping and tasting until her arms and legs ached and her own appetite was gone. She wanted nothing more than for us to simply receive. Where do we go from here? I don't know. It was one visit, one meal, several smaller ones. We ate well. We were on our best behavior. There was some laughter. Nobody cried. It does not mean that we agree on theology or politics. It does mean she's working hard, and so are we, to love as best we know how. In some ways, it was a big event, and in others, it was just baby steps. But there is, I suppose, a lesson in the way my mom cooks, something that I want to remember as we keep walking with each other. In my mother's kitchen, nothing happens quickly. You plan, you marinate, you stew, you wait. And then eventually, you feast. So fast forward 5 years to this August, and I got to take my mom to the farm. And there we were in the fields I love so much. And all I could think about was how she and my dad, who grew up poor, worked so hard to send me to college, and now she got to see her son as an overeducated peasant making $9.25 an hour. This is every immigrant parent's dream. We just slaughtered our first chickens at the farm. Don't judge vegetarians. And I saved a chicken to cook with my mom. And we salt baked it in the way of my father's tribe. My dad still won't meet my husband. He doesn't think I should be in seminary. Honestly, I'm afraid of hurting more. But I also love my dad. I know my dad loves me. So when I carved the chicken, I saved a drumstick to send home with him, with my mom. A reminder to him that even if we disagree on many things, we can agree that we're father and son. We love each other. I honor him. In the compost pile, my resentment at my parents, at the church world I grew up in, at how it treats people like me, at how it treats people unlike them, my resentment is turning. And I say turning because it's a slow progress. And anger can't be our final destination. Jesus calls us out of isolation into community, out of fear and into grace. and acknowledging God's grace helps me to show grace. Grace for my former self. Grace for my present struggle. Grace for neighbors I don't want to love. Grace for people who are where I once was. Grace helps me to say that I'm grateful I grew up evangelical because it made me me. Grace helps me to see that the theology of the compost always points us towards the hope of the eventual feast. I still don't always believe that I'm enough, and on some level, I'm not. Not by myself, not in my isolation. We need others to hold on to hope for us when we can't hold on to it ourselves. Maybe you need that here today, and many of us can do that for you. It would be an honor. Or maybe you have the chance to be the one to hold on to hope for somebody else. All of this just echoes Paul again, for I am convinced that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. This is true whether you believe in that God now or not. This is true wherever you are on your journey. This is true whether you think you've done right or whether you're worried you've effed it all up. We are God's beloved, and you are so loved. And nothing, 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 nothing in the world can change that. So in Jeff's original sermon, he asked the audience to write the fear that they had been holding on a scrap piece of paper. And some common fears from this audience included being wrong, failure, that nothing will change, rejection, that the church won't be a place where I or my child will find community, that I'm too much, that I'm doing too little, complacency, cynicism, rejection, that God is disappointed in me, that God doesn't love me, that they were right and God is really an a-hole, that it won't get better, that I'm wrong and I'm really a bad person. Jeff gathered the papers to take them back to the farm, to the compost pile, where these ideas, fears that are not of God, would die and bring new life and new growth. And on a second card, he asked the audience to write down their hopes. They were instructed to hold on to them, to remember, and to scribble down new hopes that they find. And Jeff told the audience, "Your hopes testify that God is planting something good in you and growing something powerful in you." So consider, what are your hopes? And not only as an individual, but as a community. I think I originally fell in love with this sermon because it is my favorite image of God's story of redemption. I love stories, that's what sticks with me. And I tend to think and dream in pictures. And I imagine joining this large force of earthworms with Jesus at the front, relentlessly churning death and destruction into life. And in our acts of love, we participate in preparing the soil in which God's reign of justice and love can take root. And when the world feels bleak, this is what gives me hope.
Thanks for listening to the River East Church podcast, the Jesus Community for the World. We are an Anabaptist church pursuing wisdom, prophecy, and compassion here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can find us online at rivereastchurch.ca. We hope you join us for next time, and until then, may grace and peace be with you.